I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
Flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. Backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales, visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
Good morning. It is 8:41, Wednesday, June 30th. This is the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And judging by the fact that I can't even roll out of bed without sweating, it is now summer in New York City.
You know, hi, I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. Every week I go through this, the pressure to say something clever. I can't handle it anymore. I got nothing, John.
Man, that's like four in a row. John Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And actually, I want to welcome two new listeners, Valerie Lowe and Nancy Diller, to the show. I met their daughter slash niece up in Maine, and she was very excited to hear that there was a celebrity in town. And then she got to me later on, and we talked about the show. They're Morgan owners and breeders, and they're very interested in the thoroughbred industry. So welcome, Valerie and Nancy, to the audience.
Welcome as well from me, and hopefully Bill's lack of pithy one-liners will not dissuade you from continuing to watch the show. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland, home of the world's yearling sale. Make plans to attend the Keeneland September Yearling Sale beginning Monday, September 13th. Learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. All right, so we're going to talk about racing to start the show today. I know it's going to be a pleasant surprise for many of you. Don't worry, we have some Baffert news. I know you're all waiting on pins and needles for that, but we did have some pretty good racing this weekend, and we have some pretty good racing coming up last weekend. We have some pretty good racing coming up this weekend, July 4th weekend. Going to be a lot of big names, I think, that they're going to come out to play. We'll get to that. But just a couple of performances from this past week that we wanted to mention. It was Stephen Foster Day at Churchill Downs. Pretty nice card. Obviously, the headliner was Max Field in the Stephen Foster. He had another pretty convincing win, one gear down. It was not a great field in the Stephen Foster. Unfortunately, that the quality of that race has gone down quite a bit. Like, a lot of it has to do with Dubai and the Saudi Cup being such early season goals. We've talked about that before. Maxfield, I think, is, I don't know, he's one of those horses that's very visually impressive and wins a lot. But if you know, from a figure standpoint, he hasn't wowed me yet in terms of running that big blowout top figure that suggests that he can run with Mystic Guy, who I think is the standard bearer in the handicap division right now, and is coming back this weekend in the Suburban. Like I said, we'll get to that. But Maxfield is a very, very admirable horse. I think Brendan Walsh has done a great job with him. He's obviously had some setbacks along the way, and now it seems like Brendan Walsh has gotten him healthy and right. So we'll knock on wood for that he sticks around, because he is a very cool horse to watch. But it just, I don't know, maybe it was the field and like, what else was he supposed to do other than beat those horses that were in front of him? But he's never really exploded forward as an older horse yet, at least. So I'm still waiting for that big time performance that suggests he can win a Breeders' Cup Classic, that kind of race. And obviously the other big horse of the day was Latruska in the Florida Lee. And I saw that Bill wrote in his weekend review that how nice it was that she ran on 3 weeks rest. Woo! God dang, that's a quick turnaround. But she is a very nice horse who does show up a lot. I think Fausto Gutierrez has done an incredible job with her. Good day for Jose Ortiz as well, who rode both Latruska and Maxfield. And she's a cool horse. You know what she's going to do. She's going to show that big speed, and she's going to dare you to catch her. And she's got some fight too, if she gets hooked as well. I think that's the big part of it. She's not just a runoff speed, which I think she was a little bit earlier in her career. She was kind of a runaway speed, and she would burn herself up too much. Like if you look, even last year, if you look in the Beldame where she went to the front and just went way too fast and backed up and finished last, she's not that horse anymore. I think she's a little more rateable. She does still have that front runner's mentality, but she can fight back, as we saw in the race against Monomoy Girl. And she's got to be considered the clear leader of the division right now, which is, you know, something that you couldn't have thought about. You couldn't have thought of before the Apple Blossom. Like, she was barely even on the radar before that race. And now she's won three in a row and looks to be the queen of the hill in the distaff division. I wonder if anything else stood out about those performances or anything else from the weekend for you guys.
Yeah, Joe, those are obviously the two headliners of the weekend. take a couple of subjects and one at a time here. I agree with you what you said about Maxfield. He has not blown you away. But nonetheless, go back to the Santa Anita Handicap, his first loss. I believe up to that point, he had never even cracked a 100 buyer figure. And when he lost the Santa Anita Handicap, I think there was some thought that, hey, you know, this horse was a little overrated. It wasn't worth the hype. Now, going forward, then he's really put it together, has won two straight. You were absolutely right. The Maxfield victory in the Stephen Foster came at the expense of kind of ordinary horses. But you have to say that this horse is finally kind of living up to the hype a little bit, and there might be more to come. Another interesting thing, we can talk about this when we talk about the Suburban, but if the Breeders' Cup Classic were run tomorrow, I think it's fair to say Godolphin would have the first three favorites in Maxfield, Mystic Guide, and Essential Quality. And, you know, when have we ever seen anything even remotely like that before? And of course, I'm very predictable. You knew I'd get all hot and bothered and excited about the fact that a horse actually won after 3 weeks. But, you know, in this day and age, isn't Latruska cool? You know, the trainer Fausto Gutierrez is a Mexico City based trainer. That's where he's got like over 100 horses there. And what he's been doing in the United States is kind of just a side thing. Obviously in Mexico, he didn't get the memo. Nobody told him you can't do that. And she comes and wins this. You're right. She is the queen of the hill. Let's see if Monomoy Girl comes back and what she can do against her if they have a rematch. But she's just a throwback. She goes out there, runs. She takes on all the challengers. She's a little bit like Swiss Skydiver was last year when, you know, Kenny McPeak really handled her differently than you handle for most horses in the modern age. A couple other races of note. The Mother Goose was very strange. Zagel, 18-1 in there, had never run figures anywhere close to the best horses in that race. She was able to win, and that was a little bit disappointing for Always Karina, the latest, you know, greatest horse that ever lived from Chad Brown, was undefeated coming into that race at 4-5, was second. The weekend belonged to Maxfield, but I think even more so Latruska. And, you know, obviously a couple things have to break right in her way, but I think she really deserves consideration at this point for Horse of the Year.
Well, the problem with going third is that you guys pick off all the obvious points.
Oh, boy, with the whining about going.
I really don't have anything else to tell.
We left you the Ohio Derby, pal. Come on.
I forgot about the Ohio Derby. All right. Well, let me go into a little bit deeper dive on a couple of these races. One of which, you know, the Mother Goose, which I thought actually was a nice race by Zagil. And if I actually did a double take when I looked at the buyer numbers on that race. And I have to honestly say that if it wasn't Todd Pletcher as a trainer, I would be sitting here right now going, how did this trainer improve this horse going from a 66 to a 67 buyer to a 96 buyer? What's going on? That's impossible. That's a good bit of placement. I mean, you know, but I really believe that, you know, Todd has not shown any reason to question his you know, his abilities and you know, question whether or not his horses are doing it naturally or not. I'm just saying that, like, we do jump on other trainers, you know, that have a 50% increase in buyer numbers on a win. I am not suggesting in any way, shape, or form that that's the case here with this horse. But just, you know, fair is fair. We do talk about it for other trainers. But that was a really impressive win. Obviously a lifetime best by far for her. And she looks like that she's really rounding into form as a nice 3-year-old filly. I'm going to take a little bit of
an detour.
Issue. What's that?
Detour.
You know, I'm going to say a little bit of an issue with you guys, peeing on Maxfield's Parade here. Because quite frankly, I really think the horse is a really nice horse. And obviously, again, you know, as a 2-year-old, you know, I liked him. I picked him in the contest, which doomed him for the Derby. But all he's done is win every race except for one. And he's improved his performances on every single race, except for this one. He went from a 105 to a 103, albeit he was kind of throttled down in winning the race. But to jump on Bill's bandwagon, how about a program like, you know, what Godolphin is doing? I mean, it's just unheard of. I don't remember being this far into a year and one specific program, one specific owner having arguably three of the top four, maybe three of the top five, you know, horses that are out there right now. I mean, that's unbelievable. And they're doing it in different places. I mean, you got Maxfield running, in California and Kentucky. You have Mystic Guide running overseas. You have Essential Quality basically bouncing around all the Triple Crown races and all the preps. I mean, it is, if things come together the right way, basically it's going to be the Godolphin show at the Breeders' Cup, and the rest of us are just going to be kind of like, you know, hoping that they don't run in one of our other races. The only other races that I wanted to talk about that I thought was interesting was, you know, there were two baby races, stake races at Churchill Downs, the Debutante and the Bashful Manor, and they were one race apart. And if I told you that one of the divisions was going to run 6 furlongs in 109 and 4, and the other division was going to run in 111 and 1, all of us would probably say, oh, the Colts ran faster. Guess what? The fillies ran a second and a half faster going the same distance half an hour earlier. I mean, it was just amazing. The top five finishers in the filly division would have won the Colt division. That's how impressive the fillies were in those races. So, my tip of the hat to the winners, of the placers and the showers in the debutante, because all three of them would have been graded stake winners against the boys.
Right. Well, I predicted that. I wasn't the only one, but when I was looking at the races, I thought there was at least three fillies in the debutante that would have been odds on favorites in the Bashford Manor. Like, there were three fillies that had run like 78 or 80, 83 buyers. And in the boys race, like the top buyer figure was like 64 or something. So I honestly surprised to see no cross entering or no filly entered in the boys race, because it seemed like a much easier way to pick up a graded stakes win than to run in that race. So yeah, that was pretty interesting. And we should mention that Unified got his first stakes winner with Behave Virginia in the debutante. Just to follow up on the Godolphin thing, I think this is kind of the culmination of them refocusing on American dirt horses and trying to become like a powerhouse dirt stable in America, when they're mostly known for being, you know, great overseas with turf horses and in America to a lesser extent with turf horses. But I think they've refocused in like the last decade or so to have great American dirt horses. And this is what you have at every level now, basically fillies, mares, 3-year-olds, older horses. So they really are running things as we head into the second half of the year. Just a couple other races I wanted to mention. You know, Bill joked about the Ohio Derby, but I thought that was actually a really good field for that race. I thought the top four all ran really well. Masked Parade is a very interesting horse. He ran in the Ohio Derby off of that blowout allowance optional claiming win on Derby Day at Churchill. He got a 98 buyer, which is a nice number for a race like the Ohio Derby, but I thought the top four all ran really well, especially Promise Keeper, who ended up fading to fourth. He was only being like a length and a half, but he set like a very contested pace in that race and battled back for most of the stretch and then just kind of wilted a little bit in the last 16. So I would, you know, I would throw any of those four, maybe not Keep Me in Mind, he's a little bit of a plotter, but King Fury was in there and ran a good second. I would throw at least three of those four horses in with the other contenders for the Travers and the rest of the big races, the rest of the 3-year-old year. Because like I said, you know, Essential Quality is clearly the king of the hill and Hot Rod Charlie's up there as well. But there are a lot of really nice 3-year-olds out there running across the country. You might see a couple others this weekend in the Iowa Derby and the Indiana Derby next week. So it's nice to have a deep group of 3-year-olds, even if we, you know, don't necessarily think any of these horses can jump up and beat Essential Quality. Like I said, I think there's going to be a 14 horse field on the Travers. I think a lot of people are out there with nice 3-year-olds who think, you know, if I can get a little development out of them in the second half of the year, who knows? You know, we've got a deep class at least, even if it's a little top heavy. Just a couple other, you guys mentioned Zajel. I thought that was a pretty confident spot by Todd Fletcher, and he was rewarded for it. There's a horse at Monmouth. I'm surprised you guys didn't notice. I guess you're not into female turf sprinters, but a horse named Caravelle for Elizabeth Merriman. She's owned, bred, and trained by her, and she's won a couple races in a row now and blew out the Goldwood Stakes, going 5.5 furlongs on turf. Got a 99 buyer. Go watch the race. She had a really explosive turn of foot, and you know she doesn't. I'm trying to think of the last like really good filly or mare turf sprinter that I remember, and you know, Lit Shipman comes to mind. She was more of a speedball than Caravelle is. Caravelle is kind of a sit and one run type horse, but she's the most interesting female turf sprinter I've seen since Lady Shipman. So I just wanted to give a pop to her for some smaller connections at Monmouth, who we should talk about a little bit more So shout out to Elizabeth Merriman and Caravelle. I thought that was a very nice effort. But yeah, overall, pretty solid weekend of racing. But we're going to get to, I think, an even better weekend of racing coming up this holiday weekend after this break from Keeneland.
The World's Yearling Sale. Make plans for the Keeneland September Yearling Sale, September 13th through the 25th. Visit theworldsyearlingsale.com to learn more.
Owning multiple great stakes winning racehorses like Decorated Invader or potential future stars like First Captain is attainable with a racing partnership with West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. All right, so we've kind of been grasping a little bit for stuff to talk about. In the last couple of weeks, we're really dying for Saratoga to open up, which will open up July 15th. We have a little bit of announcement about that meet and our participation in it coming a little bit later. But I think this weekend and next weekend are very nice kind of appetizers for Saratoga and Del Mar. Obviously, next weekend, we have the big Belmont Turf Festival, which is always fun. We've got the Belmont Derby. I think the Belmont Oaks is going to be an absolute battle with some really, really nice three-year-old turf fillies. You've heard me pump them up before. But I wanted to run down some of the stuff that's happening this July 4th weekend. And it starts Friday night with the Iowa Derby and the Iowa Oaks. Unfortunately, Proxy has to scratch out of the Iowa Derby with an issue. But Superstock is going to be in there, the Arkansas Derby winner, maybe a couple of other decent colts as well. We got the Cornhusker Handicap as well that night with Nick's Go, I think, is going to run in there after a somewhat disappointing effort in the Met Mile. We're going to see Nick's Go probably be a gigantic favorite in there and just pop out to the front, never look back. But we'll see. He's got a little something to prove after his last couple of races. We got the Summit of Speed on Saturday at Gulfstream. This is where I miss Calder. Like I miss Calder being able to have that day and really, you know, shine a light on them. And one of the things I liked about Calder is that it was a very different track than Gulfstream. It was a much deeper, sandier track. And, you know, if you ran like 108 or 109 at Calder, you were really moving. But, you know, it's the past. We have to move on. But Cece is going to run in the Princess Rooney. I think she's the big name there. A couple other interesting horses. Laura's Light is kind of a two surface runner for Peter Miller. She's going to be in there as well. We've got the Smile Sprint as well on Saturday. Not sure how many big names are going to be in there. Delaware has a pretty good card with the Delaware Oaks and the Kent Stakes. Looks like they're going to get a pretty big field for the Kent, at least. Los Alamitos Derby. The Los Al Derby is this weekend. Bet looks like Baffert's going to have a couple of runners in there, including Defunded. The Suburban, we touched on it before. Looks like a pretty good field for a race that used to be a grade one, now a grade two. Has had some really nice fields the last couple of years. I wonder if it'll eventually get upgraded back to a grade one, but Mystic Guide is the big name there. It's first race back from the Dubai World Cup blowout win. So we're all very interested to see him, but I think he's going to have some competition because Happy Saver is going to be in there off of it's going to be his second off the layoff. He won the Jockey Club Gold Cup last year, if you'll remember, and then skipped the Breeders' Cup Classic to prepare for his four-year-old year. He had a pretty nice allowance win about a month ago at Belmont. So he's going to try to step up second off the layoff. Country Grammar, who's now with Todd Pletcher, is going to be in there as well. Country Grammar has got his third trainer in less than a year, but is obviously a very nice horse. So that's a very interesting field. And I think, you know, Mystic Guide is going to have his running shoes on off of the layoff to you know, do what we think he's going to do and continue his really stellar, I'm going to say stellar campaign because he only ran once, but his stellar run of races, I will say. And then a couple of races overseas I wanted to mention. The Coral Eclipse is Saturday, and we're going to see Mishriff run in there. Mishriff obviously coming off of the Shima Classic and the Saudi Cup wins. Very, very nice horse and probably the most, I would say, the most famous horse that's running overseas right now. So he's going to run in the Coral Eclipse. We also have the Grand Prix de St. Cloud, which is Sunday. Great Group One in France going a mile and a half. Looks like it's going to have a gigantic field. So we'll look forward to that as well. The John Nayrud and the Dwyer also at Belmont. It's a lot of action this weekend, guys. And then the Great Lady M, we might see Gamine in there. I mean, pick your pleasure. What do you guys like?
Well, Joe, let's make sure we talk about everything and just leave the featured Finger Lakes for John so we can whine about it again. Okay. But yeah, you know, I'll go with what you said in here. A couple observations first. I thought it was very telling that Nick's go was going at Prairie Meadows of all places. Now, I know he doesn't want to run the horse in the suburban because Nick's go wants no part of a mile and a quarter. But after a real disappointing effort in the Met Mile and also running kind of, you know, a clunker a little bit in Saudi Arabia, to me, Brad Cox is not showing a lot of confidence in this horse. I don't know what else is out there for him right now, but there's got to be something a little bit more sexy than the Prairie Meadows Cornhusker Handicap, a race named for Nebraska run in Iowa with a $300,000 purse. But, you know, maybe he's looking at something. He wants an easy. You're right. I mean, this is the proverbial 1-5 shot. Maybe he wants an easy spot to get the horse's confidence back. That would make sense. And the Suburban, which has been kind of a real clunker over recent years. I mean, this is as good as any race run this year. Like you said, you know, Mystic Guide will definitely be the favorite. But how about Happy Saver? He's 5-for-5 lifetime. And in the last year's Jockey Club Gold Cup, he won over Mystic Guide. Now, he won't be the favorite in there. Mystic Guide will be, but you can make a serious case that Happy Saver could absolutely win this race. And if he does, I mean, he vaults to that number one position. And it looks like Pletcher has planned this out so that this horse can have, you know, the late spring summer campaign and go right on through to like the Whitney Jockey Club Gold Cup, Breeders' Cup Classic, things like that. Then Country Grammar is interesting for a lot of reasons. But, you know, we're seeing a lot of with the Baffert, these horses leaving his barn now. Matter of fact, a race last week at Thistledown, the Lady Jacqueline Stakes, $250,000. Crystal Ball was taken away from Baffert. It was given to Rudolph Brissett and won there. So it's interesting. How are these horses, and Life is Good, of course, we haven't mentioned that, also winds up in the Todd Pletcher barn. You know, how are these horses going to do in their post-Baffert careers? And actually, how many of these are there out there? I mean, are there more that we don't even know about? So it'll be interesting to see what Country Grammar does going out of the Baffert barn, a real mile and a quarter specialist, won the Hollywood Gold Cup. But the Suburban, to me, is the race of the weekend, an absolutely terrific race. And it really, could shake up the hierarchy of the older male dirt division.
Well, and Bill, thank you for that lead-in. Let's talk about the fifth race at Finger Lakes. You can never win two for $10,000. Entries aren't out yet, but I'm sure that we'll be talking about that very, very soon. In the meantime, let's talk about some secondary races. There are 37 stake races in the United States. And then there's a couple in Woodbine, and Joe, you mentioned a couple overseas. So next week, our show is going to be 14 hours, I believe, to go over every single horse that we have in all of these races. But the bottom line is that, you know, it's almost like the proverbial hose that we've been holding tight for the past couple of weeks and waiting and waiting and waiting for the water pressure to build up. And now it's like we have, you know, almost 40 stake races to be talking about for this upcoming weekend, which is outstanding. You guys highlighted a lot of the horses that needed to be, you know, talked about. I do want to circle back to the Dwyer, though, because I think that's going to be a very interesting race of 3-year-olds. You have Starting My Dreams, Gershwin, Pick and Time, Civil War, that are all legitimate horses. And then, fan and friend of the show, Cassius King, also has Riding with Biden, trained by Butch Reed, who's going to be running in the Grade 3 Dwyer this weekend as well. So it's really if you don't find a race that you want to watch or want to bet on, then this ain't the right game for you. It's just there's so many good opportunities, so many different fields, racetracks, distances, surfaces. This is kind of like, you know, starting to get exciting again and building up a lot of these, a lot of the meets that we anticipate over the summer, primarily because some of the racetracks are closing for their spring meet and others are open for the summer meet. So you almost have the best of both worlds. You have the quintessential ending, you know, on a strong note for some of these tracks and trying to open up on a high note for other tracks. I think it's going to be a really exciting weekend for racing.
Yeah, and you didn't even mention Mahamal, who is going to be in the fire, who's a TDN Rising Star. He's a very nice horse for Todd Pletcher and for Shadwell. But yeah, one thing I love too is that, like John mentioned, there's a lot of tracks who are going to get some shine this weekend before Saratoga and Del Mar kind of take center stage for the summer. You're gonna have race, you know, stakes at Delaware and Los Al and Prairie Meadows. Also, there's graded stakes 4 days in a row, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. We're going to have graded stakes races to watch. So it's really a kind of a blockbuster holiday weekend. And there's a lot of, like John said, if you can't find a horse that you want to watch this weekend, then you're probably not that into racing. So yeah, we'll keep an eye on everything and break down the major storylines, but it's great to have some big time racing back and not just have to talk about Bob Baffert lawsuits all the time. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
This week's TDN Story of the Week is brought to you by the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project. Find out how you can get involved in racehorse ownership this summer at Canterbury Park with several options and investments ranging from $250 to $10,000. Visit racehorseminnesota.com to learn more. This week's Story of the Week, unfortunately, is Bob Baffert again, because there was another story in the Washington Post that broke yesterday. The title of the story is "Officials Worked Secretly to Clear Bob Baffert's Justify Amid 2018 Triple Crown Run Records Show." Now, we're not going to go too deep into it. I think we're all Bafferted out by now. But this, I just wanted to bring this up, A, because it's a slow news week, but B, because this was, you know, we talked about this at the time when the Justify news of the Justify scopolamine positive broke. If you think about it, that broke when we were doing the podcast. We started the podcast in like late August 2019. Justify won the Triple Crown in June of 2018. So that kind of put it in perspective to me how long it was kept secret that Justify failed this drug test. And, you know, we assumed it at the time that this was kind of swept under the rug a little bit because it was Baffert and such a high profile horse. But this story in the Washington Post lays out kind of exactly how that happened. And, you know, I don't want to crucify anybody here or like go too deep into it, but the takeaway for me, at least from the story, was that CHRB kind of worked backwards from how can we explain this as a contamination case. A, they worked their asses off not to let it leak, at least until the end of the Triple Crown, and then kind of worked from the assumption that it was a contamination case and we're basically like pulling up weeds and stuff around the track and testing them and hoping they had Jimson weed in it. And that's, you know, that's just very plainly, that's not how regulation should work. You shouldn't be working hand in hand in concert with the trainer to keep things under wraps and make sure that the guy doesn't fail a test, the horse doesn't fail a test. In the end, they basically dismissed it. He Baffert got no fine or suspension. I believe Justify wasn't disqualified. At the very least, that should have happened. You know, even if you think it's contamination and you think it's an innocent mistake, the rules are that the horse should have been disqualified from the Santa Anita Derby, which is important because if he had been disqualified from that, he wouldn't have had enough qualifying points to run in the Kentucky Derby, no Preakness, no Triple Crown. Scopolamine is not a huge deal, I don't think. I don't think it was the reason that Justify won the Santa Anita Derby, but the story overall is the way, and it's following up on what we talked about last week, the way that regulators have worked hand in hand with Bob Baffert to kind of make things go away. And that's a problem. That's a big ass problem in this sport. And it's led us to the point that we're at right now, where we have a trainer who's more powerful than the game, who has now embarrassed us on the world stage by having his horse who won the Derby fail a drug test. All these things kind of build up and lead to one another. And then hopefully next year, when we take all of the enforcement and the drug policy out of the hands of the states and give it to USADA, we'll have less ambiguity and less incentive to work with trainers instead of police them. Then, you know, we're going to have to wait until then. But this, it's good to have this reporting to kind of show the way that Baffert was able, and even the people that are tasked with regulating Baffert were more interested in not having bad publicity than in properly regulating the sport. Any thoughts, guys?
Yeah, absolutely, Joe. Somebody said to me, what's new here? There's nothing new here. And in some respects, that's true, because most of the details and facts have been reported before. But what was new was they had a paper trail for absolutely everything. I assume they had a Freedom of Information Act demand to the California Horse Racing Board to to get access to all their records. They had emails, et cetera. And the first mistake they made, Joe, and you touched on this, was they decided to, they admit this. Some of the people in the story admit this. They decided to treat this differently than a horse testing positive in the fourth race on Thursday. They say it was more so because of Justify and the Triple Crown and everything. And, you know, that they were more concerned about that than, you know, letting Baffert off the hook. But, you know, when you approach something like that, oh, this is a big deal, we've got to treat it differently, you're asking for problems. And they went down the wrong road, and everything that they did was kind of bungled from there. And, you know, the California Horse Racing Board really did a lousy, lousy job in this. And again, you use the word embarrassment here. I think the California Horse Racing Board embarrassed itself more so than perhaps anybody else. The other thing, too, and I talked about this before when the Washington Post did a prior story about Baffert, and this is what the sport is dealing with now from not only would you say the mainstream media, but some of the most influential media outlets in the country, like the Washington Post, like the New York Times. And, you know, this is where the general public gets its meat about horse racing. They don't read the TDN. The guy who, you know, is a big sports fan might just watch the Kentucky Derby. So I thought it was interesting. At the end of the story, they have links to other racing stories in the Washington Post. Wouldn't it have been nice if they had a story about the goat that was in the stall with the Preakness winner and got him to relax and all that thing? Here are the three links that they had. The Dark Side of Bob Baffert's Reign, number one. With private eyes and political muscle, horse racing's elite pushed to punish dopers. And probably the best of all, the rise and fall of Jorge Navarro, the alleged doping king of horse racing. So next to the New York Times, I think the Washington Post is probably the second most influential newspaper in the country. And this essentially has been their racing coverage over the last year. And, you know, how bad for the sport is that? You know, I'm not going to point a finger at any individuals here, but this is what we're dealing with in this day and age. You know, what is the public's perception of where horse racing is sunk to? Well, that trail of stories, links in the Washington Post kind of suggests, you know, what the Washington Post of the world think of horse racing right now. And are they wrong? Maybe a little bit, but not a whole lot.
Yeah, and people love scandals. People love to read about the dirt and what goes on behind the scenes and you know, the salacious details of you know, the rise and fall of celebrities and dignitaries and you know, spokespeople of certain industries. And you know, right now we're in the center of the storm as the racing industry with all that's going on with, you know, from Jason Service to, you know, Jorge Navarro to Bob Baffert to whatever's going to be coming down the pike, because there will be others that are going to be coming to light that have done things unscrupulously and against the betterment of the industry. But it's no different, unfortunately, than, you know, the United States Postal Racing Club, you know, with Lance Armstrong. It's no different than Bobby Knight at Indiana or Joe Paterno at Penn State or, you know, or Bo Schembechler in Michigan, who's under scrutiny right now. Unfortunately, sometimes these individuals get to be so big that the industry feels like it has no other, you know, recourse other than to just kind of push things under the rug and look the other way. And I think that's the case right now with what's going on with Bob Baffert. He was so big and so good for so long that basically we don't have, you know, the powers that be, whether it's California Racing Association or anybody else in power that had, you know, issues or concerns with, you know, with unscrupulous trainers. They're kind of looking the other way, or they did look the other way, and look, as Joe said, for reasons not to persecute them and not to crucify them. And, you know, this is our comeuppance. This is our situation where, you know, as an industry, we were the Wild West and we didn't have the right rules and regulatories, you know, people involved. And that's what happens, because human nature is that we kind of hope and pray that nobody else gets to see this and doesn't come to light and that everything's going to be OK. The main difference between our scandal and all the other, you know, alleged scandals that are going on is that our athletes don't have a voice. Our athletes can't say, this person took advantage of me, this person abused me, this person, you know, made me do things that I didn't want to do. The horses aren't able to do that. And I think that's the reason why there's such an uproar in the general public, is that, you know, not even so much that these things happen, which is terrible, but that, you know, there wasn't anybody to stand up and be accountable for the athletes.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And just to follow up on Bill's thing, when it was like, read more. And it was those headlines. I was like, no, I don't think I will. It was not great. Not a great link tree there. We don't really, I don't like focusing on stuff like this. You know, this is not what I want to do every week. The problem is there are these drip, 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 drip stories until it becomes a gigantic scandal like we had in the Kentucky Derby. That was the logical end result of the way racing has been policed and regulated for decades. But I think the positive thing is just even since we've been started doing this podcast, we've seen a lot of movement, obviously, namely with HISA being passed. Well, I think we've seen a lot of movement just in the less than 2 years we've been doing this podcast to clean up the game and for people to, you know, who were doing the wrong thing by horses to be exposed and found out and castigated and, you know, banished from the game. I think that, you know, there has been a lot of movement in that regard and a lot of things to be hopeful about and positive about, you know, assuming we can get HISA, instated in the next year or so, in the next July. We're a year away now. But it's the kind of thing where right now, until that happens, it's got to get worse before it gets better. And that's the way I kind of look at racing right now is, yeah, I don't love this Bob Baffert controversy. I don't relish talking about it. I don't like that our sport looks like a joke and looks crooked on the world stage again. I don't like those things. But just to get it all out there and to have transparency on the issues, because they're so deep-seated and they're multifaceted and have been going on for a long, long time. To get all of this out there and to get all of the details out there about who exactly has failed, why they've failed, and what can be done to better regulate and to better organize this system, that's a good thing. Like, I don't think it does us any good to have HISA come in and we basically have no idea what exactly needs to be fixed and who needs to be taken out of positions of power and, you know, what trainers need to be kicked out. I think it's a good thing to get this all out in the open as long as there is major reform coming, which it seems that there is. I think, you know, that's the main takeaway for me is, you know, we don't like talking about this stuff, but it's necessary so we can get it all out there before, you know, we have the sheriff and USADA come through and help us clean up our sport. So, you know, we don't love talking about this stuff, but it's definitely important and we're ready for change. I think racing is finally, you know, en masse, ready for systemic change, and hopefully we're going to get it next year. We'll be right back after this message from the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project.
It's said that life is simply a series of memories we share with the ones we love. The experiences, the joys, the thrills. Imagine a life that includes meeting your very own racehorse for the first time. The thrill of watching your racehorse passing others one by one down this stretch, and then sharing the winner's circle celebration with those closest to you. Let the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project help guide you to the experiences and memories you deserve. Owning a racehorse is less expensive and more attainable than you think. Visit racehorseminnesota.com. That's racehorseminnesota.com, and begin making your memories this summer at Canterbury Park.
TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. All right, so we have an announcement to make. I'm getting like a big banner that pops down, TDN Writers Room announcement. We did this for Ocala, if you remember. John and I went down to the OBS sale and had a great time. It was a great week. It was a really good show. And extremely well produced. I think that was the main thing, especially compared to our Zoom purgatory that we remain in. But we will be back in the studio soon. That's a different announcement for a different day. This announcement is that we're going to be doing our 100th show live from Saratoga. We don't know exactly where yet or who's going to be on the show, but the three of us will be in attendance. It's August 17th. It's going to be a Tuesday. So set your calendars. It's not going to be the usual Wednesday show. They're going to kick us out of Saratoga, I think, before Wednesday. They don't want us sullying up the grounds for a second straight week. But no, it's going to be great. We're going to have a good time. Hopefully the weather cooperates. It's going to be great to see these guys in person and to be able to sit down with some guests. I think that was the really fun part about the Ocala show, was having that like rotating guest chair and having people come in and be able to shake hands and talk to guys face to face. So yeah, if you guys have anybody you want to see, you want to hear from at Saratoga, I'm sure everybody will be there because the sale is the previous week. Just hit us up, hit me up in the DMs, and we'll try to make that happen, because we're going to try to have a bunch of people on the show and make it like a really festive atmosphere. I think we'll probably set up in the backyard somewhere, but we'll see how that goes. And so we're really excited about that. John, any thoughts from someone who is now a live on scene show veteran?
Yes, we have one under our belt, which makes us immediately credible. I would have to say that the Ocala show was my favorite show without Bill. not my favorite show overall. I think it's going to be even better with Bill there, because he will be able to ask the important, thought provoking questions that Joe and I usually gloss over, because he's a professional, writer and investigator. But all kidding aside, the Ocala show was great because there was spontaneity. We had some great guests, which we will again at Saratoga. I think it's a great idea, Joe, that if our audience, sends us some suggestions as far as people that they want to hear from, because really everyone who's anyone is going to be at Saratoga, during that window between the big races and the sales that are going on there. And it just is going to be a fun, exciting kind of show. I can anticipate that it's probably going to be, 4 to 5 hours long. I just think we're going to have that great guests and that many intriguing, questions and answers. So I'm really looking forward to it. Bill, that there is a dress code up there, right? So you may have to dust off the top hat.
Bill's wearing a minute.
You're the only guy in a t-shirt this week, John. I mean, come on, pal.
Again, because my suit and top hat and tails are in the cleaners right now. plus, I have to let out the pants a little bit after all the food I've been eating. So there's that too. But no, it will be exciting. It will be great. And I anticipate that between the three of us, we'll ask at least a couple of coherent questions.
Yeah. Judd, I think the queen spilled a drink on John's tux from Royal.
Is that where it is? Dry cleaning? Is that possible? Can I ask?
I don't know. That's we're really stoked about that, and really excited to have Patty and the gang there and produce it, because that was the main takeaway from the Ocala show, was how good it looked. Like, it looked incredible. So we're gonna try to reproduce that and maybe even have a couple more guests. John's talking about 4 or 5 hours. As long as we don't start at 8:30, that's all I ask. They'll start at the crack of dawn, and then we'll figure it out from there. But yeah, so we're really excited about that. Again, like, if you have feedback or if you want to see a guest, hit me up, hit John up. We'll try to make it happen. So looking forward to that. Again, August 17th. It's a Tuesday. Our 100th show live from Saratoga. We're stoked about it.
I just can't believe we're at 100 shows.
Yeah, I know. I thought I would have strangled John by now.
That's the only good thing about Zoom.
Zoom helps. Yeah, you can't actually touch him. We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
Flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. Backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales, visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. Our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is Dallas Baker, who is the head of international operations at BetMakers, who are trying to introduce fixed odds wagering to America. Dallas, thanks so much for coming on.
Joe, everyone, thanks for having me. It's a privilege. Thank you.
We're so glad to have you. So we'll just start with some basic questions about how this is going to work and how it's going to look. I've heard that the goal is to set up fixed odds wagering at Monmouth Park by Haskell Day, which is July 17th. But just can you tell the audience how it's going to look, from a bettor's standpoint? Like, if I go to the track, how do I do fixed odds wagering as compared to just going to the window and betting paramutually? How is it going to look infrastructurally?
Yeah, Joe, that is the goal, to be up and running by the Haskell. We've got a bit of a sprint on between now and then. So fingers crossed we are up and running for it. But to answer the question, how it's going to look down the track as we evolve at Monmouth, using that as the example, you'll basically be able to go up to any teller window, the same as you have a tote bet, and the teller will be able to have a tote bet or a fixed odds bet. As it will start at Monmouth, there'll be separated tellers, so you'll have hopefully massive big signs that says bet fixed odds here. You just go up to the teller as you would normally do with a tote bet and say, I want $20 the win on number one in race one or whatever it is, and away you go. So it's pretty simple. As far as the displays goes, there'll be displays all around the course with what the fixed odds market is. And of course, when you're betting fixed odds, you're basically the price it is at the time is the price you get. So that's obviously very important to the customer, which is the punter, to be able to see that. So you'll have screens all around the place, which not only will show what the price is currently, but all the most recent fluctuations of that horse as well too. So with fixed odds, it is fixed when you bet it, but it's also a liquid market. So you can see what the popularity of that horse will be. If it's come in from 7-1 to 6-1 to 5-1 and it's now 4-1, you'll be able to see that on the screens as well too. So you'll get an idea about what the popularity of that horse has been or what the unpopularity of that horse has been as well too with the graphical displays of the odds fluctuations as well. So basically the process will be exactly the same as what you normally do for what you do having a tote bet. Instead of being a tote bet, it's a fixed odds bet.
Dallas, thanks for joining us. Bill Finley here. Before I ask a question, I just want to articulate some of my sentiments about this. The reason why I want to be a fixed odds bettor is because I am so fed up with betting on a horse that goes into the gate at 8-1, and then halfway through the race, he goes to 4-1. And this is a huge problem with the American pari-mutuel system. So, you know, anybody who has that bad taste in their mouth, this is another alternative for them. But let me get on to my question now. You have told me and other people have told me that one of the great wishes of this is that we can get the sports better to start paying attention to racing. So kind of a two-part question. What is it going to take to get the guy who's betting on the New York Jets on Sunday to now bet on the New York Jets and Monmouth Park or fill in the blank racetracks? And also, I know you haven't got to this point yet, but down the road, do we see the ability of someone with a FanDuel account or a William Hill account being able in the same wallet, the same website, et cetera, bet on sports and horse racing? Is that one of the great wishes, and what's it going to take for that to happen?
Yes, that's definitely the goal to happen, Bill. And also to get in. Oh, I'll go back to the first part of the question. So with the sports betting, that's basically the whole one of the main points of the theory about what we're trying to do and where we think this can be so good for the horse racing industry. I mean, we've seen this great boom of sports betting in the last 3 years since PASPA was repealed. And the team who repealed PASPA has been part of our team. Obviously, Dennis Drazen was ahead of that. And Bill Pascrell III, who's been our lobbyist and attorney throughout this whole process, they were two of the instrumental people in repealing that. So hopefully we can have a similar success to what the sports betting world has been. That would be huge. But if you have a look at in New Jersey alone at the moment, you're getting close to around about $1 billion a month that's being invested on sports betting. So as a racing industry, if we can tap into that and if we can be mildly successful and get 10% of that figure, and I can explain why 10% I don't think is overly, you know, is too much of a blue sky aim. If we can get that, then there's another extra $100 million that's being invested on racing, which with the right modelling then could get back into funding racing as well too. So the key to getting the sports gambler on is giving the bookmakers something to market. So fixed odds betting is something the bookmakers want to market. I've spoken to a lot of the betting firms who say that they want to actually spend the majority of their marketing budget in the next few years on horse racing. So what that does is opens up this whole new gambit of people who or organisations who have got enormously deep pockets and really want to aggressively market something and are in an aggressive marketing space at the moment with sports betting, but they want to turn that into racing. So then suddenly you're going to have millions and millions of dollars that are being invested on the marketing of racing. Yes, that's from the bookmakers trying to acquire clients, but in the same time, it's also marketing racing. For instance, say it's Monmouth on Saturday and the bookmakers are out there beating themselves over the head, trying to out-promote each other. you know, saying, you know, if for the first five races at Monmouth, if your horse runs second or third and you backed it to win, you get your money back. Yes, that's promoting their business, but at the same time, it's promoting Monmouth Park as well too. So you'll see that. So, and then that's the external advertising from it, and then the internal advertising from the bookmakers who have got millions of people on their list. And the critical thing about the people on their list, their main age is between 20 and 50, which is an age group that is probably being lost to racing a lot. So suddenly you've got this whole new group of people in that key demographic, which obviously like betting, which can easily translate across to horse racing, given the right product. Now, we've made a major capital investment in the US in buying Sportech. So, I mean, we obviously think that the tote and fixed odds works well, worked side by side to each other. But the tote isn't something as much that gravitates towards the newer player as what fixed odds betting does. So that opens that up to it. So creating a product that the bookmakers can market, then that opens their pockets to market to a lot of people, and then that brings across their customers who are currently betting on sports betting. So that's the goal, and I think we've seen it enough around the world to know that people will translate. We'll cross over to racing, given the exposure, basically, because at the moment I don't know if we're really reaching that demographic, and by having bookmakers who can market this product, that demographic is opened up. So that's one of the main things. And then to answer the second part of your question, Bill, yeah, so that's the goal, is to have all of the sports skins in New Jersey, and then hopefully eventually building out across the US to be able to offer it. So if you go onto your whatever your betting account, whatever your preferred wagering operator account is, if you're seeing a bet on the Giants, or you know, or a market on the Giants, or a market on anything else, then side by side with that will be a market for Monmouth Park as well too. So, you know, by exposing that to people, hopefully that the plan is for that they'll just naturally gravitate across and get involved in the great industry of the horse racing industry.
No, great answer. So Dallas, let's fast forward now a couple of weeks. Fixed odds wagering has been introduced into the United States. Haskell Weekend is come and gone. What bogeys or benchmarks are you guys looking at where you say, if we get X number of accounts open, X dollars that's wagered, then it was a success? What is a success for you guys the week after the Haskell?
I think the week after the Haskell, I think we've got, we're not sitting here anticipating that we're just going to flick a switch and there's going to magically all happen. We know we're here for the long haul. That's hence why our original deal with Dennis Strazen at Monmouth Park is 10 years. The real big question, Jonathan, is what is the timeline for it to resonate? And that's the answer that I really don't know. Is it 6 months? Is it 12 months? Is it 2 years? Somewhere in that timeline it will. And going back to what I was sort of what I intimated at before, look, if we were to get 10% of the sports betting market, I would think that, as I said, that's highly achievable. I would like it to be a lot more than that, and I think it can be a lot more than that, but just getting 10%, which is would be a minor success, I suppose, I would say it, but that would be a huge benefit for the racing industry. So I think what I'm saying is that we're aiming to be hugely successful, obviously, but if we were it to be only a minor success, I think it had then that significance to what it can return to the racing industry is massive. So, you know, we've got lofty goals, but if we only sort of get somewhere towards those lofty goals, I think it should still have a significant impact on the horse racing industry.
For sure. And I one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is I think this is a very plainly good thing. Regardless of what the scale of success is a good thing to introduce to the American betting market, which I think has a lot of deficiencies. The parallel that I think is obvious to draw is Betfair. When Betfair came over here and started the Betfair Exchange, also in New Jersey. Now, I think your product is better because there's guaranteed liquidity, whereas with Betfair, there wasn't necessarily, you couldn't necessarily find the price that you wanted, depending on who was on it at the time. But the problem that Betfair had, I think, and why they struggled is that they were only in New Jersey. They only had a couple of like lower level tracks to bet on. Obviously, understandably, your goal was to get set up at Monmouth and get everything going and working there. But beyond that, if you can look beyond that a little bit, what kind of strategies or plans do you guys have to branch out beyond Monmouth and, you know, get some other tracks on board?
Yeah, lovely. Well, just on the Betfair thing too, and I would really hope that Betfair does become part of the becomes part of the wagering ecosystem, because the more things that we can offer the customer, which is the punter, there's not many industries that don't benefit from servicing their customers better. And by giving them the option of the tote, of fixed odds, and of the exchange, obviously is better for the customer. But I think one of the main reasons why Betfair wasn't as successful here as it could have been, and I think it probably will end up being that. But Betfair, really, the exchange needs fixed odds betting. One of the main things about exchange betting is arbitraging. And it's very hard to arbitrage if you don't have a fixed odds market next to it. So it's sort of like the exchange is the higher level form of punting. I think fixed odds is the most simple, and in between is the tote. And the exchange really does need the other two pillars there to exist. So I think once we get a good, healthy, robust fixed odds market up, then the exchange can come back in and play a really, really good role. And as people get more educated and more price sensitive, and knowing that, okay, this I can buy this price on fixed odds and then I can sell it over there on Betfair, and all I'm doing is waiting for the race to start because I've already made my profit. So that's I think where you'll see the exchange succeed. But yeah, obviously long term, the more tracks, the merrier. First and foremost, we've got international content from, you know, all corners of the globe. In New Jersey, unfortunately, we can't bet on greyhound racing, but we at BetMakers, we probably, I think we're up to about 5,000 races a week now that we send out to our bookmaking clientele. Obviously, a lot of them are greyhound races, so I'd imagine that's sort of like something like about 2,500 races that will come in internationally into bookmakers in the US. And then we've got another probably about 10 or 12 tracks that'll be part of the service. Our plan for the first week or two is probably just to do Monmouth only. Hopefully do it very smoothly, but obviously just, you know, keep it controlled, and just, you know, the first couple of weeks has been Monmouth, and then we'll start rolling in the content from all around the US, from a lot of the tracks around, or from many of the tracks around the US, and also from all the international sources as well too. And at the same time too, I think realistically, Monmouth will be probably the first venue up, and as the other bookmakers finalise their IT integrations and all the other things that need to go into running a race book.
Hey, Dallas, I want to pick up on what Joe said and try to pin you down a little bit, because it's important. I understand Betfair is different than fixed odds wagering, but conventional wisdom was that when Betfair was not able to get the Stronach tracks, Churchill Downs, Naira, Keeneland, Del Mar, they were left with secondary products that weren't that attractive. How important is it to the future of fixed odds wagering to get those tracks that I just mentioned? And what is your confidence level that they will eventually sign up? Because, I mean, to be honest with you, a lot of people in the U.S. look at this and say, oh, my goodness, if they just offer Penn National and Finger Lakes and my favorite racetrack, Fawner Park, it's not going to work.
Yeah, look, I think where the big difference is with Betfair, it is require liquidity is obviously the most vital thing for the exchange. So you can't, it's very hard to have something with a lower level of liquidity build and build and build, because you can't get through the ceiling on that, because it just, you need, the exchange needs liquidity. With this, it gives you, there's a lot more room to move and a lot more room to build, because the bookmaker's putting up an odds, and somebody wants to have 10,000 on it, they can have 10,000 on it with the bookmaker. It's not reliant on having that 10,000 in the pool to be able to have that size of bet. So it does give you the opportunity to grow slower and build up. Where we're confident is, obviously, I mean, we would love to see all of the content from around the US on, but we're also very aware of the commercial intricacies that exist in the US horse racing industry. But we're very confident that what we will see is these tracks, the tracks that are on board and the tracks that are dipping their toe in at the start, are going to get massive benefits. And I think very quickly you'll see through this and through the power of the marketing, remembering Betfair was just one group doing one thing based on a model that does require fixed odds. When now we expand it out, and then you're talking about multiple bookmakers promoting it, backing it, getting behind it, then we're confident is that we're going to see these tracks that are on board are starting to start getting a lot more revenue. And when they start getting a lot more revenue, you become bigger pretty quickly. So I think that what we've planned out is that the tracks that are on board to become very, very successful, hopefully in using that timeline. I'm, you know, again, hopefully it's within 12 months, but, you know, fingers crossed on that, how long it takes to resonate. But I think what you'll see is those tracks will get great benefits from it. They'll start getting the revenues back. They'll start paying more money to the horsemen. You pay more money, your field sizes increase, you might put on an extra race. And then it just becomes a self-fulfilling formula that it leads to greater returns for the horse racing industry.
Yeah, and Dallas, one of the things that we go through on this show is, you know, we make the assumption that bigger fields automatically means that more people are going to bet. Based on the analysis that you guys have done, is that the case? And a second question is, does it matter if it's a 12-horse field of $5,000 claimers or a 12-horse field, you know, at the Breeders' Cup?
It was a while ago I saw the study, but I think the optimum field size for betting is about 14 runners because then over and above it gets a bit scary, but then under it's not as many. So the more runners you get, definitely the more turnover you get, as simple as that. I suppose that's a question that I'll answer in two ways. What we've seen in the last few years is an explosion of global content going around, and you know, luckily we've been part of the distribution of that. So what we've seen with turnover, and naturally, of course, a Breeders' Cup and a Kentucky Derby Day are probably the exceptions. But just maybe if you just pull that back a bit and just say, like, your stock standard grade one race, what you find, the further away you get from the where the host jurisdiction is, so using Australia for an example, really the quality of race, the importance of that to the punter probably degrades as the further you get away from it. So what we've seen with turnover in Australia, it really from a feature race product, obviously your feature, your super duper ones are always going to resonate. But it really comes down, the level of turnover internationally, it just really comes down to the time zone that hits and the quality of the product that the track is putting out from their video presentation, how it looks. And, you know, like, so if it is using Bill's term, Fauna Park, or it's Belmont, if people are there betting on it in Australia or in foreign countries, it's not as big a divide as it is over here as you get closer to it. But yes, in the US, obviously, the better the grade, naturally attracts more people. You know, I mean, it's not a revelation to say that the better the racing, the more people are interested in it. The more people are interested in it, the more people are going to bet. So, obviously the higher the level of the race when you are in the local area, obviously the better it is.
Dallas, you just mentioned Australia, but I don't think we've told that story. And I know that one of the reasons why your firm and Monmouth and Dennis Grayson is so bullish on the odds, the idea of fixed odds wagering, is because you have an example from Australia about what happened when it was implemented there. So just basically tell us the Australian story.
Yeah, probably about 10, 12 years ago now, Bill, we were, as a racing industry, we were coming to the end of a very protracted legal battle that had to go through the Supreme Courts, and where basically bookmakers were, best way to describe it, it's probably a grey market in Australia. They were licensed in one territory of Australia and really couldn't advertise, but sort of were allowed to bet, you know, so that typical grey market. So there was the battle from the racing industry to say that they were entitled to charge for the product, and this is the model that we're bringing in here. And I don't think anybody who's a racing enthusiast would do anything but argue to say that the racing industry has a right to get some sort of kickback from people wagering on the racing product. So that was a protracted court battle about 12 years ago. The end result was that racing was allowed to charge for its product, but also too that deregulated the whole bookmaking industry, which allowed the bookmakers to act fully legal and market and do all that. So you saw the huge explosion in marketing from that in the 10-year period. Basically, turnover has doubled in Australia. The amount of money that has been bet on tote and tote products has pretty much stayed the same. But the doubling in handle has come all from fixed odds. The great news for that for the racing industry is with that modelling of the industry being able to charge the bookmakers a fee on their handle or turnover, as we call it in Australia, is that prize money has doubled in that time too. And also track safety, horse welfare, all the multitude of lists of the expenses that go into running horse racing and running horse racing in a 2021 type style where welfare and safety is obviously taken leaps and bounds in it, but that does also cost money. Essentially from the model that has been brought in Australia, we've seen growth of about $12 billion a year now. It's just above $30 billion a year in handle. As I said, all of that, most of that has come on the back of fixed odds betting, and prize money has doubled in that time. I mean, like a standard Saturday race in Sydney or Melbourne was roughly about $60,000 10 or 12 years ago. It's now $120,000, $130,000. So, there's a lot of money that's being thrown back into the racing industry on the back of fixed odds betting.
And we're looking forward to that as well, hopefully in America. Because like I said, no matter what happens, I think it's great that you guys are doing this, and it's something that's sorely needed in the American betting landscape. So we wish you guys the best of luck, and we'll be keeping close watch, and we'd love to have you back on in the future, hopefully when we're nationwide.
Hopefully, Joe. Thank you very much, and thanks for your time. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Great to have you, Dallas. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Dallas Baker will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. A reminder that the Keeneland September yearling sale starts Monday, September 13th. You can learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Dallas Baker, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Ritz, and our editors, Nathan Wilkinson, Anthony LaRocca, and Aliyah LaRocca. Thank you so much for watching. We will see you next week.